Today is Thursday, August 19th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, opposition figures threaten armed resistance against the Taliban.
That Ahmad Shah Massoud's son has announced that he will resist. Afghanistan's former vice president, Amrullah Saleh, said that he will resist.
Plus, UN seeks protection and asylum for Afghan refugees.
More than 500,000 Afghans who have fled their homes this year because of conflict and insecurity remain displaced inside the country.
Also, South Africa marks killing of 34 miners at a platinum mine. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Reports indicate opposition figures are gathering in the Panjshir Valley north of Kabul, the last area of Afghanistan not under Taliban rule. They are threatening to launch an armed resistance under the banner of the Northern Alliance, which allied with the U.S. during the 2001 invasion. They include members of the deposed government, Vice President Amrullah Saleh, who asserted on Twitter that he is the country's rightful president, and Defense Minister General Bismillah Mohammadi, as well as Ahmad Massoud, the son of the slain Northern Alliance leader Ahmad Shah Massoud. This comes as the Taliban celebrated the country's Independence Day on Thursday, by declaring they beat the United States in the two decades war. For more, I spoke with VOA's Aisha Tanzim.
We know that Ahmad Shah Massoud's son has announced that he will resist. Afghanistan's former vice president, Amrullah Saleh, said that he will resist. It's not clear yet whether they have support for this resistance, how much support they have, how many people they have, and whether they will be able to withstand a Taliban assault if Taliban start looking at them. I think what the Taliban are focusing right now is to try to negotiate with the political leaders in Kabul, which is Hamid Karzai, Abdullah Abdullah, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, and they're trying to form a shura or some form of setup that gets them international recognition. And it seems from multiple chats and talks that I've had with various players in this saga that the Taliban are desperate for international recognition. So if they receive that international recognition, and that will depend a lot upon what kind of deal they have and whether they give these minorities a role in the government, if they do that and they receive an international recognition, then we'll have to see whether the resistance will still continue or whether people will come into the fold and ask for their share of the power. But that is still in the future. What we are seeing in Kabul right now is Taliban going to political leaders and talking to them. Resistance is out there, but it's still early and it's yet to be seen whether that gains momentum.
With international and local skepticism, and of course, growing economic difficulties, does this report of resistance, will that not resonate with the people of Afghanistan?
I would hate to speculate on it because, yes, would people want to resist? The Taliban, we've seen it. Some people went out and put up Afghan flags and there were protests in favor of the old Afghan flag, not the new one. But the thing is that people also are watching how the Afghan army literally packed up and unfolded and retreated in the face of Taliban advances. So whether this resistance has the muscle that it takes to actually stand up to Taliban, who have now captured almost the entire country other than the Panjshir Valley, that is yet to be seen. If the international community recognizes the Taliban, then the resistance will be further weakened because then they will be resisting against a recognized government.
The World Food Program, speaking about Afghan people living in open spaces and parks and economic difficulties and ATMs not working and food prices going up. How bad is the situation?
The Afghan rupee's price has fallen. This country was already in dire straits. I mean, even before the Taliban takeover, the UN said half the country's population needs humanitarian aid really badly. So you can imagine how bad the situation is now if the half the country needed it badly already. And now there's uncertainty, banks are closed, offices are closed, nobody can get their money out of the ATM. So a lot of uncertainty right now.
That's VOA's Aisha Tanzim speaking with me from Kabul. The race to evacuate tens of thousands of Americans and Afghans from Afghanistan is intensifying as prospects are uncertain for removing any Afghan allies after August 31st. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Barb has the latest.
Hundreds more U.S. troops arrived at Kabul's international airport to help evacuate American and Afghan citizens.
This is personal, and we're going to get them out. We've already evacuated approximately 5,000 people, and we intend to increase it.
But outside the airport, evidence the evacuation now hinges on Taliban cooperation, with reports of militants blocking the passage of the Americans and Afghans the U.S. has vowed to save. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin told reporters U.S. troops would stay focused on protecting the airfield. Chaos and panic on Monday halted air traffic there for hours and led to multiple deaths.
I don't have the capability to go out and extend operations currently into Kabul.
Kabul fell quickly Sunday as ousted Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled the country. He spoke to the Afghan people via Facebook Wednesday.
I was forced to leave Kabul to prevent bloodshed and destruction of Kabul.
The U.S. vowed to complete its troop withdrawal by August 31st, but that may not be enough time to evacuate everyone at risk.
The fact of the matter is we are going to do as much as we can for as long as we can. If the window is 2 weeks, we will make the most of that window. If the window is slightly longer, we will make the most of that window.
And in a candid interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos Wednesday, President Joe Biden gave little hope for rescuing Afghans beyond the end of the month.
No, Americans don't understand that we're going to try to get it done before August 31st.
But if we don't, the troops will stay.
If we don't, we'll determine at the time who's left.
And
if there are American forces, if there's American citizens left, we're going to stay till we get them all out.
A message certain to disturb the thousands of at-risk Afghans yet to be evacuated and their American allies desperate to get them out. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Afghan women and girls who have won freedom they could not have dreamed of under the last Taliban rule that ended 20 years ago are desperate not to lose them now the Islamist militant movement is back in power. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
A group of Afghan women holding signs and protesting for their rights on the streets of Kabul. Women and girls in Afghanistan are desperate not to lose their freedoms now that the Taliban are back in power. Afghan activist Pashtana Durrani runs an organization that provides access to learning materials for 7,000 girls, mostly in rural areas across Afghanistan.
As an Afghan woman, I wouldn't trust them because they don't have a very clear track record of being keeping up their promises or something like that. And the Taliban should give a statement out that all these girls should be going to all these public schools and no foot soldiers are allowed to harass them or target them or stop them. And then they should continue the way they are studying, right? If they're okay with all that, we're good to go. Then I'm optimistic, but they have to walk the talk. Right now, they're not doing that.
In their first press conference in Kabul, the Taliban pledged to respect women's right to work and education, but only within the framework of Islamic law.
Women will be afforded all their rights.
The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, expressed cautious optimism about working with Taliban officials, citing their early expressions of support for girls' education. But many others remain skeptical. Several women were ordered to leave their jobs during the Taliban's rapid advance across the country, and activists say they want to see the Taliban held to account for any commitment. During their rule from 1996 to 2001, guided by Sharia religious law, girls were not allowed to go to school, women could not work, and had to wear burqas to go outside.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. UN agencies are appealing to countries not to abandon the Afghan people in the midst of their country's unfolding humanitarian crisis and to offer protection and asylum to those in need. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 500,000 Afghans who have fled their homes this year because of conflict and insecurity remain displaced inside the country. So far, few people have fled across borders as refugees seeking international protection. But the UN Refugee Agency says this could change at any time. It warns of a potential mass exodus given the dangerously fluid and uncertain situation prevailing under the country's new Taliban rulers. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu says many Afghans fearful for their lives might decide to seek international protection abroad.
UNHCR remains remains concerned about the risk of human rights violations against civilians in this evolving context, including for women and girls, those perceived to have a current or past association with the Afghan government, international organizations, or with international military forces. States have a legal and moral responsibility to allow those fleeing Afghanistan to seek safety and to not forcibly return refugees.
In the wake of the rapidly deteriorating security and human rights situation in Afghanistan, the UNHCR is calling on states to keep their borders open to Afghans fleeing persecution and violence. It also is appealing to states to not forcibly return Afghan nationals, including rejected asylum seekers, to their country where their lives might be in danger. The UNHCR welcomes recent steps taken by 9 European countries to temporarily halt deportations of failed asylum seekers. The agency also praises Pakistan and Iran for their decades-long generosity in sheltering millions of Afghan refugees. The UN Human Rights Office agrees the safety of Afghan civilians, particularly at-risk groups, are of paramount importance. Agency spokesman Rupert Colville says his office has received chilling reports of human rights abuses and of restrictions on the rights of individuals, especially women and girls. These violations, he says, reportedly have occurred in some parts of the country captured by Taliban insurgents over the past few weeks.
Member states need to use their influence with the Taliban bilaterally and multilaterally to protect civilian lives. States have a duty to use any leverage they have to de-escalate the situation, install calm, and ensure protection of at-risk groups.
The Taliban have made statements described by observers as encouraging in recent days. These include a pledge of amnesty for those who have worked for the previous government, as well as assurances that women can work and girls can go to school. All pledges, the Taliban says, would be within Islamic law. Colville says only time will tell whether the Taliban will honor their promises, whether their actions will match their words. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Biden administration announced plans to offer booster shots for Americans who have been fully vaccinated. Esha Sarai has more.
As just over half the American population has been vaccinated, the Biden administration announced Wednesday that it would provide booster shots for Americans 8 months after their second vaccine.
8 months after your second shot, get a booster shot. These booster shots are free. We'd be able to get the booster shots at any one of approximately 80,000 vaccination locations nationwide. It will be easy.
Top scientists in the U.S. have said that vaccines have proven effective against even the Delta variant.
Even though this new data affirms that vaccine protection remains high against the worst outcomes of COVID, we are concerned that this pattern of decline we are seeing will continue in the months ahead, which could lead to reduced protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death.
But the decision to offer booster shots in the U.S. has drawn criticism from public health organizations, which note that much of the world is still struggling to get a first dose of the vaccine.
The decision to push booster shots in the United States is just one more step that our government is taking that's going to widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And this isn't just a moral stain on wealthy nations. It's really going to prolong the pandemic for everyone.
Biden responded to this criticism by noting the number of vaccines the U.S. has donated to other countries.
No, there's some world leaders who say America shouldn't get a third shot until other countries got their first shot. I disagree. We can take care of America and help the world at the same time. In June and July, America administered 50 million shots here in the United States, and we donated 100 million shots to other countries.
Washington's decision comes in defiance of the World Health Organization's call for a moratorium on booster shot discussion until more of the global population is vaccinated. Isha Sarai, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America. Tensions have been growing over the slow pace of aid efforts in Haiti after a powerful weekend earthquake killed more than 2,100 people and then was followed by a drenching tropical depression. At the small airport in southwestern community of La Caisse, a police officer fired shots to disperse a group of young men among throngs who have gathered to watch aid being unloaded. Israel's health minister says he has lifted restrictions on blood donations by gay men, saying the long-standing query posed to prospective donors was discriminatory. Nitzan Horowitz, who himself is openly gay, wrote in a Facebook Thursday that the health ministry had, quote, removed the denigrating and irrelevant questions, unquote, and questionnaires for blood donors, and that everyone will be treated equally regardless of sexual orientation. The decision comes shortly after a similar decision by the US and the UK in the past year. Indonesian police say they have arrested at least 53 suspected militants in recent weeks, believed to have links to banned extremist groups, in a nationwide crackdown on a new cell of Jamaah Islamiyah, blamed for a string of past bombings. Police say the arrests were made in 11 provinces in the past 2 weeks, including 5 men who were arrested on Thursday. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Commemoration events are being held in South Africa this week for 34 miners shot dead by police during a strike at a platinum mine near the town of Rustenburg in 2012. The incidents become known as the Marikana Massacre and was the most lethal use of force by South African police since 1960. In 2015, a judge recommended that the police who opened fire on miners, some who were armed with clubs, spears, and other weapons, be investigated. No such probe has ever taken place. As Darren Taylor reports, relatives of those who lost their lives feel let down by South Africa's justice system.
In the build-up to the shootings, miners striking for better wages killed 2 police officers. At the time, Cyril Ramaphosa, now South Africa's president, was a non-executive director of the Lonmin Group, which owned the mine. As the strike grew increasingly violent, Ramaphosa called for concomitant action to be taken against miners, but the judge who led the inquiry exonerated him from any responsibility for the killings. The inquiry did, however, question the fitness for office of now-retired police commissioner Ria Piecha and the actions of then-police minister Nati Mtetwa. It also condemned the police for using excessive force, but no one has ever been charged for any criminal offence connected to the shootings.
9 years on, still no justice.
Musi Maimane was a senior member of the Opposition Democratic Alliance when the Marikana massacre happened.
We cannot cheapen the lives of miners, all in the interest of extracting resources for the benefits of a few at the expense of the many.
He says the African National Congress, or ANC, government has covered up the truth about what happened at the mine.
I asked her that day, I said to her, Ria, who gave the order to send mortuaries and to send bullets to the people? She still could not answer. I still have not gotten answers.
He, like many other South Africans, believes that while police pulled the triggers, senior ANC politicians were pulling the strings behind the scenes.
That's why none of them have been arrested and none of them have been charged. Whilst in fact the orders would have come from the top to ensure that live ammunition in a democratic government was used against the poor of this nation who were simply demanding not just a wage, but dignity.
The state has, however, paid some reparations to relatives of the slain miners. Solicitor General for the Department of Justice, Fedzisani Pandalani, says it settled 35 of 36 claims brought against it by families of the Marikana victims.
The quantum of the amount that has been paid to date is 69,083,000 rands.
But Pandalani says the group representing the families, the Socioeconomic Rights Institute, has made a further demand of general and constitutional damages. The institute's demanding an additional 1.5 million rands for each of the miners' families. Pandalani says the state's hoping a compromise can be reached. Meanwhile, the relatives of the Marikana victims say they'll take the money because they need it, but they'd rather go to court to see punishment for those who shot their loved ones dead. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Rights group Amnesty International says Somalia's struggling healthcare system has been crippled by the coronavirus pandemic. The group released a report Wednesday titled, quote, "We just watched COVID-19 patients die," unquote. It calls for urgent investment in Somalia's healthcare sector after years of neglect. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The Amnesty report quoted a senior Somali doctor saying in one ward on the same day four elderly men died within 10 minutes because of lack of oxygen. The Rice Group Somali researcher Abdullahi Hassan says health resources are so poor that medical workers too often could only stand by and watch their patients die.
When COVID-19 pandemic came, it laid bare how bad the situation was in Somalia. For example, the response by the government was wholly inadequate. There was only one hospital in Mogadishu that managed COVID-related cases, and that one hospital lacked essential equipment. Health workers who worked in that hospital, they really struggled with patients. They did not have enough equipment. They did not have oxygen supply.
Amnesty says the Somali government allocates only 2% of its budget to healthcare, while security services got the largest share, 31%. Officially, Somalia has had more than 16,000 infections and almost 900 deaths from COVID, but the country's chief medical officer, Dr. Mohamed Mahmoud Ali, told Amnesty the death toll was certainly far higher. Dr. Ali said only those who managed to get to the health facilities and get tested were included official data. The figure is just the tip of the iceberg, Amnesty quoted him saying. Many more were infected and died at home. Amnesty notes that only 15% of Somalia's rural population have access to medical care, and the country has only one surgeon for every 1 million people. Abdikadir Abdirahman Aden is the founder of the Amin Ambulance Service, the only such service for Mogadishu residents. Aden says they have two ambulances to serve people. The ambulance workers get exhausted and it's challenging to get oxygen. Since they provide a free service to people and the companies producing oxygen want money, he says they have problems with oxygen supply. Aden says their ambulance workers are also not very well trained to handle some health issues. The Amnesty report, based on interviews with 33 medical and aid workers, as well as officials and experts, calls on Somalia to use debt relief to invest more in healthcare. In March 2020, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank reduced Somalia's debt from $5.2 billion to $557 million over 3 years. The debt relief aims to bring the Horn of African nation back into the global economy after 30 years of conflict and unstable governments. Amnesty Hassan says the debt relief also offers an opportunity to improve Somali hospitals.
All this money that is going to be received through debt relief should be managed in a manner that is transparent, that's accountable, and it should be used to improve the health sector in the country.
Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
World stock markets are retreating after U.S. central bank policymakers made no firm decision on when to unwind their support measures for the economy. In afternoon trading, France's CAC 40 was off 2.3%, Britain's FTSE 100 had given up 1.7%, and Germany's DAX had dropped 1.7%. In Asia trading, the Nikkei 225 in Tokyo closed 1.1% lower, the Kospi in South Korea lost 1.9%, the Shanghai Composite Index fell 0.6%, and Hong Kong's Hang Seng closed 2.1%. Wall Street opened lower, with the Dow Jones Index and Nasdaq Composite both off about half a point. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA. Coming up, a conversation with Tunisia expert Amy Hawthorne about the future of that country's experiment with democracy. The only country to have thrown off the yoke of authoritarianism is showing signs of backsliding. What precipitated the crisis in Tunisia, and what are its prospects for holding on to its hard-won democratic gains? That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice.